Well, the lady has taste.
Now, this separating door, was it open the morning the body was found?
It was. let me just refer to my notes. Yes. The French maid Celestine brought up tea to Mrs. Manderson at about 7 o'clock as usual. Also, as usual, she shut the door between the two bedrooms so as not to disturb Monsieur.
So she came in from there and shut the door so, which means she couldn't see into her husband's room as she did so.
Correct. She could see nothing of the adjoining room. That is why it was assumed Manderson was still in his room while Mrs. Manderson was breakfasting, rising and performing her ablutions.
Did the maid also open the windows?
They were already open. Mrs. Manderson needed to sleep with plenty of fresh air. The maid merely opened the curtains.
Mm. Now, what sort of person is she, this maid?
French.
But a reliable witness.
No great ally of Mr. Manderson. She didn't like the way he'd been making her mistress unhappy. I don't regard her as a suspect, though.
Whom do you regard as a suspect, Inspector Murch?
If I'm pushed?
Mm-hmm.
Martin, the butler.
Ah.
At least as a preliminary theory. Now, as this. There's a plan of burglary. Say a couple of men in it and Martin squared. He's told them where the place is and all about the valuables in the drawing room and elsewhere. Martin leaves the French window in the library ajar, accidentally on purpose, and they walk in and sample the whiskey to give themselves Dutch courage. Now, Manderson isn't asleep yet, and hears them, thinks it's burglars, gets up very quietly to see if anything's wrong. He creeps down on them, they cut and run. He follows them, catches them up by the shed, there's a fight, one of them loses his head and makes a swinging job out of it. Now, you pick that to pieces.
Oh, very well. Just to oblige. First, no traces of burglars, and nobody hears anything of the stampede through the library or any shouts from Manderson inside or outside the house.
Oh, no.
Next, in your long experience, did you ever hear of a householder getting up in the night to pounce on burglars who dresses fully?
Oh.
Underclothes, shirt, collar and tie, trousers, waistcoat and coat, socks and hard leather shoes, gives the finishing touches to his toilet by fastidiously parting his hair.
Point
and
taken.
Putting on his watch and chain. Any item he seems to have forgotten was his teeth.
I did say it was only a preliminary theory.
Where do the two secretaries sleep?
Their rooms are directly opposite. I'll show you.
Thank you. Don't tell me this is John Marlowe's room.
Got it in one.
I haven't met Mr. Bunny yet, but I somehow don't see his room as being full of golf balls and fishing rods.
there's only one thing of interest. It's in that leather case.
This one?
Open it.
A revolver.
With the initials J.M. engraved on the stock. John Marlowe. Now then, take a look at this. Dr. Stock just had it sent over for me.
Is it the bullet?
Found lodged in the bone at the back of Manderson's skull.
Could it have come from this revolver?
It could indeed. I know about firearms, Mr. Trent, and I can categorically state that it was fired by a weapon of this make and caliber. These marks were made by the rifling of the barrel, a barrel exactly like this one, and there is no other revolver which marks the bullet just like this.
This mystery is all wrong. Now, let's see where we stand. Marlowe was...
in Southampton.
Yes.
Left about 10 o'clock and didn't return until many hours after the murder was committed.
You're sure?
Positive. I questioned him late last night. He arrived in Southampton about 6:30 on the Monday morning.
Now, is there any corroboration?
Oh, yes. I also wired our people in Southampton. Early this morning, I got this reply.
Thank you. Person answering description in motor answering description arrived Bedford Hotel here 6 a.m. today, gave name Marlowe. Later inquired at docks with passenger named Harris on Havre Ferry. Repeatedly until about 1:15 p.m. Left soon afterwards in car. Company's agents inform berth was booked name Harris last week, but Harris not on boat. Signed Burke, Inspector.
You see? His own story borne out in every particular. Also, he sent a wire to Manderson. Harris not turned up. Missed boat. Returning Marlowe. It was duly delivered here in the afternoon and placed among the dead man's letters. In due course, Marlowe arrived back here dog-tired and nearly fainted when informed of Manderson's death.
It was unlucky for Manderson that Marlowe left his revolver and cartridges about so carelessly, don't you think? Wasn't that rather throwing temptation in somebody's way?
Oh. I wouldn't attach too much importance to that revolver if I were you. It's common enough over here. Calvin C. Bunner, at your service.
How do you do?
In fact, Mr. Manderson had one just like it. I expect you are Mr. Trent.
That's quite right.
You thought I might have been eavesdropping, perhaps? No, sir. I just heard a word or two about the revolver, that's all. It's what we call a Little Arthur back home, and I dare say there are duplicates of it in 10,000 hip pockets this very minute. I consider it too light in the hand myself. I prefer something heavier. Feel that, Mr. Trent. Be careful. It's loaded.
Yes. Tell me, Mr. Bunner, did Mr. Marlowe have need of a revolver?
He bought it to please the old man. Manderson said it was ridiculous for a secretary of his to be without a pistol.
Oh, why do you think Manderson said that, Mr. Bunner? Did he feel threatened?
I believe he knew there was something coming to him, something he couldn't dodge.
Indeed.
There was a change in his manner these last few months. He was gloomy, sullen, as if he was everlastingly brooding over something bad, something he couldn't fix. Then a couple of weeks back, his self-restraint began to go. I'm the only man who knows it, but when he was alone with me in his office, if the least little thing went wrong, he'd fly off the handle. And this was a man who always kept himself well in hand. His calm was deadly. I never saw anything like it.
And nobody saw this side of him but you?
I guess not.
And you put all this down to some fear that somebody had designs on his life?
I do.
Who?
Oh, there was a whole crowd of dangerous men scattered up and down the states who had it in for him. I mean, take the Pennsylvania coal strike alone. There were 30,000 men who would have jumped at the chance of drilling a hole through the man who fixed it so they'd either starve or give in to his terms.
That was years ago.
So what? They've been known to dynamite a man in Idaho who'd done them dirt in New Jersey 10 years before. And the Atlantic's not going to stop them.
Hmm.
Well, well, well. Well, deeply obliged to you, Mr. Bunner. Your theory is perfectly rational and appears to fit the facts. Now, my stomach says it's lunchtime, and whatever you're doing now, Mr. Trent?
Oh, just looking at Mr. Marlowe's shoes.
What about them?
Oh, nothing. They're just half a size larger than Mr. Manderson's, that's all.
Oh.
That's all. Shall we make a move? It's about 2 o'clock.
10 a.m. in little old New York. And I hope we never see anything nearer hell than what's loose in Wall Street this minute.
Good morning, my dear Trent.
Ah, good morning, my dear Cobbles.
They said at reception that you were still at breakfast.
No, almost finished.
Are you coming to the inquest?
No, I think not. I've still some work to do at the house. Now, I have little doubt that the good Dr. Stock will bring in a verdict of murder by person or persons unknown.
Oh. Definitely not suicide, then.
Oh, no. This was a premeditated crime. An extraordinarily cunning one at that.
Huh?
Well, I'm ready now. Shall we walk up to White Gables together?
Yes, by all means.
I'll just go and get my camera.
You haven't yet had occasion to speak to my niece.
No, not yet. I have observed her, though.
Oh?
Yes. On the cliff top this morning. I usually take a walk before breakfast. I suddenly became aware of a woman sitting nearby, her arms drawn up about her knees, her face full of some dream. She was dressed all in black, but with great taste. It could only have been Mrs. Manderson. The lady is astonishingly beautiful.
Yes, in mind as well as body. Ah, look, here she is. Let me introduce you properly. Mabel, my dear.
Good morning, Uncle. And this is Mr. Trent?
Yes. Good morning, Mrs. Manderson.
I wish you success with your investigations.
I thank you.
Do you think you will succeed?
Oh, yes. Yes, I believe so, Mrs. Manderson. But I may find it necessary to consult you before my conclusions are published.
Of course.
In fact, may I ask you a question or two now? Nothing, I think, that you would rather not answer.
The inquest, Trent, that will be ordeal enough.
Uncle, I don't mind. Ask your questions, Mr. Trent.
Thank you. Your husband had in his desk an unusually large sum of ready money. Have you any idea why?
I can't imagine. And I'm very surprised to hear it.
Why surprised?
I thought my husband had very little money in the house. Because on Sunday night, just before he and Mr. Marlowe went out in the car, he came into the drawing room and asked if I could let him have some money until the next day. I gave him all I had in the house. It was about £30. He put it in his pocket.
He did not tell you why he wanted it?
No. He seemed to be irritated about something and said he hoped a drive in the car by moonlight might help him sleep. I remember thinking it odd that he should want money on a Sunday night. He usually kept about £100 by him. But I didn't pursue the matter. I'd forgotten all about it.
It was curious, certainly. Mrs. Manderson, when your husband went to bed that night, were you still awake?
Oh, no, I dozed off. I was half aroused by the light going on in the adjoining room. I was very drowsy, but I believe I asked what time it was and if he'd enjoyed his drive in the car.
And what time was it?
Oh, 11:30, he said. His usual bedtime. And he said he'd changed his mind about the drive.
Did he say why?
Yes. He said he'd sent Mr. Marlowe to Southampton to bring back some important information from a man who was leaving for Paris by the next day's boat. He said Marlowe could do the journey quite easily if he had no accident. Then he explained that he'd gone with Marlowe for a mile or so, and then walked home, and that he felt all the better for it. He was most forthcoming. Unusually so.
Which brings us, I fear, to a more painful subject.
Yes?
Your relations with your husband.
Oh, Trent, I beg of you.
It is all right, Uncle. I'm sure the subject will come up at the inquest.
Oh, very well.
During the last few months of my husband's life, he changed towards me. And his attitude gave me great anxiety and sorrow. He'd become very reserved, mistrustful. He avoided my company.
And you?
Tried to work against it. Did all I could, with justice to my own dignity.
And you never asked him what was wrong?
No. I only made a point of being to him exactly as I had always been, so far as he'd allow me.
There were never any words between you?
Never. Now, if that is all, I think we should be leaving, Uncle, if you'd give me your arm.
Yes.
Are you coming with us, Mr. Trent?
No, Trent isn't attending the court, Mabel. He's continuing his investigations here at the house.
Ah.
I'll see you later, Trent.
Yes.
Come along, my dear.
That is a wonderful woman, Mr. Trent.
Yes, indeed. Apropos of nothing in particular, were you at Oxford, Mr. Marlowe?
Yes. Why?
Just a guess. Who's Harris?
Harris? Oh, nobody knows, not even Banner. All I know is that when I was in London last week, I booked a deck cabin at Mr. Manderson's request for a Mr. George Harris on the boat that sailed on Monday.
And your errand to Southampton?
Manderson said he simply wanted me to find Harris and bring back a message from him. I was further told that Harris mightn't turn up. If he did, every moment was of importance.
But wasn't it an extraordinary thing to send you dashing off like that in the middle of the night?
It was about 10 o'clock, to be exact. Not that I'd have been surprised if he'd roused me out of my bed at midnight. Manderson had a taste for the dramatic. He'd suddenly decided that he wanted to have word from this man Harris. I accepted it, and that was that.
Why should he then have told Mrs. Manderson you were taking him for a midnight run?
I've no idea.
And Martin was told the same thing.
You know as much as I do, Mr. Trent. He came with me for a short way, then walked back. I drove on to Southampton. Now, if you'll excuse me, it's time I was going to the inquest.
One thing more, Mr. Marlowe.
Yes?
Just look at these. Closely, if you please.
They come from a diary, don't they? From the October pages for this year. Well, there's no writing on them.
Have you ever seen them before?
No. To my knowledge, nobody here has any such diary. Ah, telegraph.
Are you the gentleman, Mr. Trent?
Yes, I am.
Telegram for you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Uh-huh.
It must be good news.
Not exactly news, Mr. Marlowe. It tells me only that another little guess of mine was right.
Yes? Oh, couples. Come on in.
Thank you.
How did the inquest go?
Murder by person or persons unknown, as you expected.
Did Dr. Stock pass an opinion on the time of death?
He did. 6 to 8 hours before the finding of the body, based on rigor mortis. Why?
Well, to begin with, there are things that may
hasten or retard the cooling of a body. Mm-hmm. This one was lying in long dewy grass on the shady side of a shed. As for rigidity, if Manderson died in a struggle or labouring under a sudden emotion, his corpse might stiffen practically instantaneously, particularly where there's damage to the skull. On the other hand, stiffening might not have begun until 8 or 10 hours after death. Excuse me.
Oh, sorry.
I want to get to the light.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
What are you doing?
However, what we can say is this. He wasn't shot at a time when people were awake, say after 6.30 a.m. And since Martin sat up until about 12.30, that leaves us with about 6 hours during which the crime could have been committed. Unless...
Unless what?
Yes. This is pretty good negative. Washed enough now, I think. Let's leave it to dry and get rid of all this mess.
What is all this?
Oh, it's called a hypo-eliminator. It's very useful when you're in a hurry with a negative. Did you know there's a very good dark room downstairs?
Trent, please tell me, what is going on?
Would you like to see a little bit of high-class police work? Now, just getting to the interesting bit, as you came in...
Well, yes,
now, can you, without touching it, tell me what this is?
Yes, of course I can. It's a small glass bowl. It looks like an ordinary finger bowl.
Right. Now, take this bottle, pull out the cork...
Right.
Excellent. Do you recognise the powder inside?
No.
You swallowed pounds of it in your time. They give it to babies. No?
No.
Well, it's a grey powder, is its ordinary name. Mercury and chalk. Well, it's splendid stuff. Now, pour a little of the powder over this part of the glass bowl.
Huh?
Good. I can see you've done this before.
I haven't, I assure you. It's all a complete mystery to me.
Now, I dust the powdered part of the bowl lightly with this camel hair brush... And what do you see?
Two large grey finger marks on the bowl. They weren't there before.
Allow me to explain. The human hand, even when quite clean, is never quite dry. And sometimes, in moments of anxiety, for instance, it's very moist. And when you pick up an object, like a finger bowl, you leave traces upon it which are practically invisible. That bowl was picked up by somebody with a rather moist hand, and quite recently, too. Now... If we sprinkle some of the powder on the outside of the bowl, so, the thumb mark comes to light. This is of the index finger, a single spiral whorl with deltas symmetrically disposed, and this, the print of the second finger, is a simple loop with a staple core and 15 counts. How do I know there are 15, you ask?
Well,
because I have the same two prints on this negative, which I've examined in detail. See for yourself. See the bifurcation of that ridge? Well, there it is, in the other. See that little scar near the centre? Well, there it is again.
Yes, yes, I see.
They were clearly made by the same hand.
Oh, without doubt. Where did you photograph them?
On the inside of the left-hand leaf of the front window in Mrs. Manderson's bedroom. The bowl comes from Manderson's room. It contained his false teeth.
Then, presumably, they are Manderson's finger marks.
I wonder. Shall we see if we can match them once more? I believe we can.
Now what?
Lamp black. Now, do you know what this is?
Yes, a blank page from a diary.
My diary, to be precise. October. Right. Take the page in these tweezers.
Oh, yes.
I'll sprinkle some of the lamp black onto the surface of the paper. So. Now the other side. So. And... Clearly printed in black.
The same two prints we saw on the bowl and the photographic negative.
Same man, you see. Well, couples, now I know. Now I know.
Well, I'm still completely in the dark.
Why don't we go for a walk along the beach, my friend? I'll tell you the painful truth.
It all began with the shoes.
Whose shoes?
A pair of Manderson's, black patent leather. He'd been wearing them the evening before he died.
Well, what about them?
The stitching was split in such a way as to make me believe the shoes had been worn by someone for whom they were slightly too small.
But why should anyone wear them?
That is precisely what I ask myself, Couples. And suddenly ideas rearranged themselves in my mind, and I found solutions to problems which had previously baffled me.
Such as?
Why was Manderson so untidily dressed when the body was found? Why were the cuffs dragged up inside the sleeves of the jacket? Why was his watch in the wrong pocket of his waistcoat? Why was he not wearing his false teeth? And more, why wasn't he heard as he left the house that morning?
Why did nobody hear the struggle and the shot?
I'll tell you why. It was not Manderson who was in the house that night.
Oh, but that's absurd.
Is it?
Well, people saw him at close quarters.
Oh, but did they?
Mrs. Manderson spoke to him as he went to bed. Indeed, found him strangely forthcoming.
But she never actually saw him, because the open door connecting her bedroom with his would have hidden him from her view.
Martin saw him. He said so at the inquest.
Martin thought he saw him. What in fact he saw was a man wearing Manderson's smoking jacket and broad-brimmed hat, hunched over a telephone.
He spoke to him.
Oh, yes, he did. Which gives us clues as to the man's identity. One, he was sufficiently closely connected to the dead man to be able to deceive both Martin and Mrs. Manderson. Two, he was roughly Manderson's build, though his feet were slightly larger. Three, he was a good actor and mimic. And four, he had a minute acquaintance with the ways of the household.
Why? Whoever he is, should he go through with this charade?
Because it was necessary for him to create the belief that Sigsbee Manderson was alive and in the house until sometime after midnight that Sunday.
And he wasn't?
No.
Manderson was dead before the false Manderson came to the house.
Am I to conclude from this that you believe the false Manderson to be our murderer?
Mm. And a very cool customer into the bargain. He shoots Manderson, probably at some distance from the house.
Yeah, which would account for nobody hearing the shot.
Dumps the body by the shed, puts on Manderson's outer garments, and removes Manderson's false teeth. He then walks quietly to the house, ensuring that he makes clear footprints in the gravel of the path. On reaching the library, he helps himself to a stiff whiskey.
Well, that's hardly surprising.
He rings for Martin, successfully passing himself off as the man's employer. Oh. Then he shuts himself up in Manderson's bedroom and prepares convincing evidence of its having been occupied by Manderson himself. He places the shoes outside the bedroom door, throws Manderson's outer garments over a chair, puts the denture in the bowl by the bedside, selects a suit, a pair of shoes, and a tie from Manderson's wardrobe. While he's doing this, he hears the sound that he's dreading most, the drowsy voice from the adjoining room. Once again, as with Martin, he successfully mimics Manderson's voice and then settles down until he's sure Mabel Manderson is sleeping soundly. He then leaves the house on tiptoe by way of Mrs. Manderson's window, knowing that Martin will be alert and on duty downstairs, awaiting the expected telephone call.
That doesn't make sense, Trent. It was the impostor himself who instructed Martin to wait up. Now, why?
He needed an alibi.
Marlowe? Oh, not Marlowe.
Oh, yes. John Marlowe's presence in Southampton at 6:30 the following morning provided an airtight alibi only if the murder was assumed to be committed sometime after 12:30. It would be physically impossible for the car, a 15-horsepower, four-cylinder Northumberland, to get to Southampton by 6:30 unless it left Marlston by midnight at the latest.
So, Marlowe quietly leaves the house by way of my niece's window, dresses Manderson's body in the brown suit he's taken from the wardrobe,
making several crucial mistakes in the process.
And drives off at high speed to Southampton.
Precisely.
There could be no doubt about it, I suppose.
Unfortunately, none. The fingerprints on the glass bowl and on the window are definitely Marlowe's. Also, I sent a telegram to a personal friend who's a fellow of a college at Oxford, asking if John Marlowe had any connections with acting while at the university.
And?
I received his reply this morning. Marlowe was a member of the Oxford University Dramatic Society for 3 years, played Bardolph, Cleon and Mercutio, excelled in character acting and imitations, and was the hero of some famous hoaxes.
Conclusive, then?
I think so.
And his motive for murdering Manderson?
Remains to be seen.
Trent. Hmm. What do you intend to do?
The first thing must be to write all this up for the newspaper. And then...
Yes?
And then I must nerve myself for what may prove to be a most distressful interview.
Good morning, Mr. Trent.
Good morning.
Please, do come in and sit down.
Thank you.
You look wretchedly tired.
I've been working half the night on my final report to the Record, and thinking hard for the rest.
Your final report?
I have it here, in this envelope.
You know the identity of the murderer?
Oh, yes.
Well, then...
Mrs. Manderson,
forgive me, but first, may I ask you some further questions?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course.
Is it true that you have no idea why your late husband changed his attitude to you?
I've told you so already, Mr. Trent. And I said so again at the inquest.
I do not believe you.
You're accusing me of perjury?
I am accusing you of not telling the whole truth. I need to know.
Very well. The whole truth, however painful. Our marriage wasn't a very successful one. I was only 20. He was the only strong man I had ever known. But it didn't take me long to realize that he cared more for his business than he did for me. His main purpose in marrying me, I think, was to have at his side a wife who would take an important place in society, do credit to his position in the world. And I found I couldn't.
Please continue.
Can you think what it means to step out of a world where there was always some creative work in the background? Work with some dignity about it. Men and women with professions or arts to follow, ideals to believe in. Some of them wealthy, some of them poor. Can you think what it means to step out of that world into another where you have to be rich, shamefully rich, to exist at all? Where money is the only thing that counts and the women live for display and silly amusements and silly immoralities. It was so empty. I did try to adjust. I went on trying. And I never told him how I felt. But I was a total failure. I used to steal holidays now and then, and with old school friends, perhaps, who couldn't afford to travel. Or I'd stay in London quietly with people who'd known me all my life, and we'd tell each other about cheap dressmakers and sit in cheap seats at the theatre. They were my happiest times.
And your husband discovered this?
It happened last year. I don't know how. Some woman may have suggested it to him. Because the women all understood, of course. Anyway, he said nothing to me. But I sensed that he knew, and after a while we were just being polite and considerate to each other. And I felt the whole basis of our living together was going under my feet. Then at last it was gone.
And that is the whole truth?
Yes. You still don't believe me?
Oh, I want to.
But?
I have to ask you one last brutal question.
Yes?
Mrs. Manderson, will you solemnly assure me that your husband's change towards you had nothing to do with jealousy towards John Marlowe?
Oh.
I need your assurance, Mrs. Manderson. That is all I wanted to know. I'll leave my manuscript on the table. Do what you like with it. As far as I'm concerned, the case is closed. I'm deeply sorry.
My dear couples, I have cut and run. What else could I do? I love your niece. I've loved her from the first moment I saw her. She's all you said of her and more, much more. I'd resolved at our first meeting to take you every step of the way, and I'll do so now, even though it causes us both pain. You asked about Marlowe's motive. It was love. His love for Mabel Manderson.
Obsessed by his passion for her, and witnessing every day the evidence of her unhappiness, he planned and then performed Manderson's murder. Murder, for a woman's sake, is, heaven knows, not all that rare a crime. But it needed all his intelligence and all his daring. Did it also require your niece's complicity? That is the dread question I've asked myself a thousand times. Did she know the murder was brewing and keep silent? Or worse, did she plan it with him, assist him in his escape through her bedroom window? Was she even the ruling spirit in the crime? I fancy not. In her presence, I have felt an inward certainty of her ultimate goodness of heart.
I can believe that in her destitution she turned to that graceful and handsome young man. But I cannot believe that she had any knowledge of his deadly purpose. You know her better than I do. I'm sure you will believe the same. I have left my manuscript with her to do with as she wishes, and I have returned Sir James's check. In the circumstances, it seemed the only honourable thing to do. I see no chance of anybody else hitting on the solution to the crime, so it is our secret alone, and I have no doubt that you will share my wish that it remain so. I must try to get her out of my mind, so I have asked Sir James to send me somewhere, anywhere, as the Record's own correspondent. I leave tomorrow for Curland and Livonia to cover the revolt. They say time heals. I hope and pray it may be so.
Goodbye, my dear old friend. Yours, I, Philip Trent.